Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. I like this song because it's angry music.
That's my boy, Em.
Exactly. Same,
my dad.
Same initials as me. Marshall Mathers, Michael McNamara, Mickey Mantle, Mickey Mouse. That's right. Boom.
Same. My dad loved Eminem.
Really?
Yeah. Doe loved the Dre. The Dre and Em and Dre's crew.
Anyway, it's angry music. Oh, here it is. This is the whole version. That was just a little bit of an extract, making a bumper out of it. But joining me is Corporal Ben Lunak, United States Marine Corps, retired. And he's joining me, and we're going to talk about something that he wrote. But we'll play a little bit of this in honor of Dwayne Lunak.
Shot. One opportunity. Seize everything you ever wanted. One moment. Did you capture? Just let it slip. Yo. His palms are sweaty. Knees weak. Arms are heavy.
That's awesome. Your dad liked Eminem.
Oh, yeah. That song fires me up. I feel like smashing my head through a windshield.
Does it? I mean, I think it does that. That's what I used to play this in Afghanistan. I have like a 15-minute bumper of just the instrumental part, that boom, 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 boom. And I put that on. No, it's angry music, man. He's an angry dude, man. He makes angry music. And this song is a fighting, right, competitive, angry song.
Yeah.
I remember, I can't remember which Super Bowl it was, but when this song was huge, Ray Lewis, like, singing this song in the tunnel as the Baltimore Ravens came out to play somebody, they were fired up, too.
I wouldn't want to cross paths with him when he's fired up.
No. I don't know if you want to cross paths when he's not fired up, let alone when he's fired up, especially to this song. But
yeah.
All right, Ben, we're going to tell Ben Lunak's story a little bit. So, Ben, born and raised where?
Grand Forks, North Dakota.
Exactly. Ben and I meet when he's probably 19, 20?
I was 21. Yeah, 20.
And
no, yeah, 20.
20 years old. And I'd come back from being in Iraq. And I knew Ben's dad because Ben's dad was on the Grand Forks City Council, and I would later get elected to that city council. But Ben's dad was on that city council, and I would used to have him on my radio show on occasion. So I walk in to do a promotion ceremony because I was one of the few Marine officers in the region, for God's sakes. at the VFW on the Minnesota side of the river, so East Grand Forks, Minnesota, and I see this PFC standing there, got a name tag on, and he's pointing, telling me where to go. Hey, it's in there, sir. And I see the name. I said, Lunak, man. There's not that many Lunaks around here, man. Are you? And he said, yes, sir. He's my dad. So, refresh my memory. What pointed you in the direction of the Marine Corps? I mean, because the Marine Corps, I mean, the Army National Guard is big up in the Northern Plains because it's everywhere. The Army's big because Army bases, Air Force bases everywhere.
Yep.
Marines, not too many Marines up in that neck of the woods. So how did you get pointed towards the Marine Corps?
Well, my dad's dad is a Marine, and my mom's dad was a Marine. My mom's brother is a Marine. And everyone Of course, I wanted to join the military after I seen Red Dawn, like in 1990. I was in first grade at the time. And I saw that. I'm like, oh, that's something I want to do. And I would bring up the Marine Corps, and every single person was like, oh, you won't make it. You know, people die in that training, and you're not for the Marine Corps. So when I hear someone tell me, like, hey, it's not for you or it's not for anybody, I'm automatically drawn to that because not many people do become Marines, and not many people have the desire to become Marines. You know, that's why they say Marine by God, because God already chose the Marines that he wants, and there's nothing we can do about it as individuals. We just go there.
Whoa, and, what is that whole thing? American by birth, Marine by the grace of God, or something like that?
Yeah, drunker by... All I know is drunker by choice, Marine by God.
So that's... let me tell you, that's powerful, though, when you have in your family like that, on both sides of your family, and you see the pictures growing up, and and you hear the propaganda that those guys talk. When they talk about the Marine Corps, I mean, that's powerful stuff when you're, you know, when you grow up in a family.
Yeah, my mom's brother, Brian, he went to boot camp when I didn't quite understand it. I was still young, but I knew he was going on. I thought he was, like, training for war. He's going to go to combat. So I looked up to him. And when he came back from boot camp, he gave me his little 8-point cover, Marine Corps cover, and I would wear that everywhere. And
that was it then. That was it. Say no more, man.
Yep. And then when I did enlist, the actual day that I enlisted, I was mowing my lawn, and I'm living with my mom, and, you know, 9/11 still fresh, and the war's all over the news, and it was something I always wanted to do, and it just hit me then and there, and I left the lawnmower in the middle of my mother's front yard and got my little Honda and went down to a recruiting office. It was like, hey, I want to be a Marine. And I went in there earlier in the year, and I showed interest, and the recruiter did his thing.
Just so everybody knows, the recruiting station is next to Columbia Mall on South Columbia Avenue, mm-hmm. or whatever the hell it is, in Grand Forks, North Dakota, just for mm-hmm. everybody who's listening out there.
And... when I walked in the second time, the recruiter was on the phone, and his jaw dropped, and I said, hey, I'm effing ready to be a Marine. And he was like, hey, you would not believe who just walked in my station. I'll call you back. And the recruiter was like, you really want to be a Marine? I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, well, meet me here tomorrow at 5:30 a.m., and we'll get it going. And I showed up the next day, and the rest was history. Went home, I'm like, hey, Mom, guess what I did? I just joined the Marines. And I remember her, she, like, collapsed down to her knees, like, out of, like, just shock and awe and what have you done, you know?
You shocked and awed your mom?
Yeah, believe it or not.
Dude, what's up with that?
and they give me this little card. I was so proud to, like, all it said was, like, hey, Ben Lunak going to boot camp, whatever, the date, and... I was, like, so proud of that, and I was showing everybody, and, of course, they're like, you're never going to make it, and you'll be home in a couple weeks, you know, but sure enough, I made it. It was hard. I'm not going to lie to you. It was very hard, but after about a month in boot camp, then I pretty much adjusted well.
When you first got there, what was the hardest thing about boot camp?
Just being isolated, cut off from all your friends and family and just the outside world. And plus, we're in beautiful San Diego, so I was on the third deck of the building. So we got to see the beautiful San Diego skyline and cruise ships flying by and the airport right next to it. And you just see, like, the freedom that civilians have and that we have as civilians in this country, but it also motivated me to, you know what, that's what I'm protecting. So it took about a month to realize that. It was hard. They put me on this thing called trial training, and I was pretty much a shitbird the first couple weeks in boot camp, but I got my stuff together real quick and realized what I was doing there. And then they meritoriously promoted me in boot camp.
Get out. You went from shitbird to the outhouse to the penthouse?
Yep.
Wow. That's awesome, though. That's a great story.
Yeah, it was by far one of the most challenging. I mean, of course, it's done now.
Right.
And the thing about boot camp is, like, the Marines, they're known for their boot camp.
Right.
That people don't know about the School of Infantry or even the challenges you get out to the fleet. So when I graduated boot camp, I thought it was over. I'm like, yeah, I made it. You know, we get to School of Infantry, we get knocked down again. And then graduate that, like, finally I'm going to be treated like a normal person, but you get to your unit, you're the new guy, you know what I mean? And you got to earn the respect and trust of your fellow Marines, and it's hard. It's hard. I think it was harder than boot camp because it's the real deal now. Like, no one is there. The drill instructors are not there anymore to tell you what to do and how to do it. It's now your squad leader and team leader, and it's real. Like, we're going to war, you know what I mean? And but I was very fired up and just excited and just I'm a high strong person, very intense. And the Marine Corps was like the one organization that accepted me for that like embraced it. And was like, no, you need to bring that intensity. Do not shy away from it. So I think that's why I shined a little bit in the Marine Corps.
Let's say, come on, man. The land of the misfit toys. We embrace the crazies, right?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
You've got a home with us, man. Don't you understand?
Yep.
No, I mean, it's the truth. I mean, yep. You look throughout our, you know, the history of the Marine Corps and the people that have gravitated and, you know, it's door number four, man. You can go serve with the smart people. You can go see the world. You can, three and four are kind of the same. Three is pretty reasonable. Four is crazy, hysterical recruit training and officer candidate school full of narcissistic, crazy people screaming and yelling in hysteria. Which one do you want? Oh, I want number four. Okay. I don't think you really understood what you just told me because let me explain that shit to you again.
Yep.
No. I want number. I mean, that's, and again, this is when you're stupid, right? And you don't know the difference between the mythology and the truth. You learn that later. But think about that now. How you look at that still to this day, and you're like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, I think about this every once in a while. When I was in the Marine Corps, if I was not uncomfortable or if we weren't in some shitty situation, I wasn't happy. You know what I mean? And I really embraced the training and the just miserable. And I remember the worst training day ever or training cycle ever that I experienced was, we're in 29 Palms. It's 115 to 120 degrees. We're out in the middle of the field. We were out in the field for, I think it was a 5-day block. Well, the first day and a half, there was a snafu. We didn't have any water. The only water we had was the two canteens that each of us carry, and it was warm. It was hot. It was hot water. The only MREs that we had were the scraps from leftover field operations. And I was hungry, and we were running combat drills and with full gear on, and people were falling out because of heat cramps and starvation and dehydration. And I'm sitting there smiling, having a good time, and I'm like, man, this is the life right here. And I was so hungry, but I had no food, but I had a carton of cigarettes. You know what I mean? Got to keep the priorities straight. I was so hungry by the end of that. And still, this is how disgusting I think black bean burritos, MREs are. My buddy had a black bean burrito from an MRE. He's like, hey, you're hungry, you can have this. And I literally was like, no, I'll rather starve than eat that. That's how gross I think black bean MREs are. Ugh.
That is awesome. So, yeah. I want to do some chronology. Mm-hmm. When, what year do you enlist? In the Marine Corps?
I enlisted in April of 2004, and September 18th of 2004 rolled around, and I went to the recruiting office for some reason, and I just talked to the recruiter. I said, everyone's trying to talk me out of this. I don't want, I mean, I want to do it, but everyone's trying to talk me out of this. I'm just giving you a heads up. Well, the next morning, I'm getting ready for work. It's about 6 a.m., and I'm working at the grain inspection. My phone rings, and it's the recruiter. He's like, hey, do you want to go to boot camp early? Because I was scheduled to leave in November of 2004. I said, well, how early's early? He's like, oh, about 6 hours from now. I'm like, hey, I'll call you back in 10 minutes. And I said, call me back in 10 minutes. I hung up the phone. I called my mom. I'm like, hey, Mom, I'm leaving for boot camp at 12 today. And she was at work, and she's like, do not leave without saying goodbye to me. I'll be home in a couple hours. Just please do not leave. And that was the day I went out. I got on the plane and went to MCRD San Diego. Oh, yeah. So this whole the reason I'm telling that story is because it just it's crazy, like how everything lined up the way it did from the day I enlisted mowing my mother's lawn, from the day I'm leaving to, you know, like throughout my whole Marine Corps career. It was like that, very spontaneous, very, very quick, or I guess sudden changes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought every single one of them were for the better, I think.
Every one of those quick decisions were for the better.
Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. Oh, but
wow.
Then...
Because most people, right, are terrified to make, you know, to make decisions like that, right? To do something that quick, they'd be like, oh, no. But I'm you know, I don't want to out myself, but I'm like that too. I make quick emotional decisions. You know, I didn't, for instance, when I joined the Marine Corps, I did not look at any of the other services. You know, people say, well, did you do that? Like, no, I didn't do any of that, man. I I wanted to be a Marine. I'd seen Marines in California growing up, and I wanted to be what I saw. I'd seen the movies. I'd read something about the history of the Marine Corps, and I wanted to be like them. And if I joined the military, I knew exactly what branch of the service I wanted to be with, and I wanted to be a Marine. So my story is a little bit like that in terms of, you know, I walked in, I was a college graduate, I was working for Merrill Lynch in Los Angeles. And right? And I went down to get my, and I'd been thinking about it. I wasn't happy doing what I was doing. In fact, I hated it. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, and I sat down and I wrote, like, things I'd like to do. And, you know, and I thought, well, you know, if I think I'd like to coach and teach, or, you know, I'd like to be, you know, join the military. But when I said military, it was Marine Corps. And so I went down to get my federal, so this is a few weeks later, I go down to get my federal tax forms, and there's this gunny smoking in the doorway. It's like 4 in the afternoon of RS Encino in the San Fernando Valley, and I'm walking down this hallway looking for the place where you get your tax forms at the federal building. And he looks at me and goes, how's it going? And I've got a blue suit on and a white shirt and a maroon tie on, like the whole, like, bullshit financial dude, right?
He's styling and profiling.
Exactly. So I walk in, and he's smoking, right? Leaning against the door, he goes, hey, man, what's up? And I said, nothing. How are you? And he said, I said, I'm all right. And he looked at me and he said, you interested in joining the Marine Corps? I said, if I am, do I talk to you? And he starts laughing. He goes, nah, man. He said, look, I'm just giving you a tough time. He said, you guys like you don't join the Marine Corps. I said, well, if I wanted to, do I talk to you? And he said, yeah, you talk to me. And I said, all right, I'll be right back. He said, yeah, you will. And so I show back up in like 5 minutes after I got my forms. And he said, look, man, you don't need to waste my time. I said, no, I'm not. I'm interested. So, but he's not an OSO, right? So he's not an officer's recruiter. So he calls up, and I didn't realize what he was doing until years later, but he was arguing because he wanted credit for me. And he's like, nah, man, this guy's good to go. He'll go. He'll go. Mm-hmm. But, and so I'm like, what are they talking about? And that's how I joined. I signed the papers and I didn't, like, what do I do in the Marine Corps? Like, I didn't know. Like, well, what could I do? They showed me a picture of an F-18. How'd you like to fly one of these? I'm like, all right, that looks like a good time. Will they let me? He's like, yeah, if you can pass the vision test. So I went and I passed the vision test. And I signed an aviation contract.
Oh my god!
Exactly, it was like shit show time. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm kidding. Like, but I wanted to be. I knew what I had seen, and it motivated me. And I wanted to travel. I wanted to be outside. I wanted to be more than anything else. I wanted to be on a team. And what I saw in the Marine Corps was the quintessential team. And that was really the motivating influence of joining the Marine Corps, is that I wanted to be on a team because I had grown up being on teams my whole life, and I missed that, and I hated going to work, and I didn't want to feel like that. So anyway, yeah, sometimes it works out. I mean, it worked out for you. It worked out for me. Did all right.
Yeah. I did go to different services when Bad Boys 2
came out. Come on. What's up with that?
Dude, I saw Bad Boys 2. I saw the Coast Guard just getting after it with the Blackhawks shooting at the boats. I'm like, that's what I want to do. And I called the recruiter, Coast Guard recruiter. The closest one in Grand Forks is down in Minneapolis. And I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, I shit you not. He said, hey, you're better off joining the Marines, man.
What?
I was like, yeah. I was like, all right.
You know, hey, he'd already made mission that month.
Yep, probably. Yeah, and then
he got his quota.
And then I went to the Army recruiting office, and I just didn't feel right there. I mean, if you looked at the recruiter, he's looking just sloppy. He looked like he didn't take any pride in himself. And you know how the recruiting office is set up: is Marine Corps, right, Air Force, then the Army. And then, of course, after I left there, I just had a feeling like, do not, whatever you do, do not join the Army. And then I enlisted in the Marines, and then, of course, the Army recruiter was on my butt the whole time. I was showing up at my house, calling me all the time. And when I enlisted in the Marines, the recruiter talked to the Army recruiter, and the Marine told him, like, hey, he'll join when he's ready. That's why the Marine Corps recruiter never called me nothing, because he knew, he's like, he'll join when he's ready. And he didn't tell me that until after, of course, I signed the contract and everything. And he was like, yeah, I knew you were going to join. I just didn't know when. And I said, I just had a feeling just to leave you alone, and you'll do it when you do it. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Listen to you. All manly and butch and everything.
Yeah, right.
At the age of 19.
Yeah, knew everything at the age of 19.
There you go, figuring it out. So we're going to talk about something that Ben wrote. Memorial Day weekend is coming up. The nation will celebrate this weekend. Celebrate is probably not the right word. It will commemorate Memorial Day here this coming weekend. And he wrote something, but we got to talk about, you got to kind of lay out your career, the story. First of all, tell everybody what you're doing now.
Right now, I am a police officer in Colorado.
There you go. You worked for how many years to do that? Well, so everybody knows, Ben is a single. He's a single amp. Your right leg?
Yep, right leg below the knee.
All right, and so how many years did you work after you came home to, once you decided that you wanted to be a police officer, how many years did it take you?
13. And six of those were ground-pounding work the last 6 years.
All right.
But it took 13 years total, 28 applications.
There you go. Tell everybody's story about Ben was on, I don't know, a few months ago, and we were talking about this. But tell the story about the day you got your badge and Marines stopped the ceremony because they wanted to take the stolen valor burden off your shoulders. Okay. Tell that story. This is an awesome story.
So in the Marine Corps and Infantry, I think it'd probably be Marine Corps whole, like you're not a Marine until you get a combat action ribbon, which is the ribbon that you get after you've been in a combat situation. Well, my time I served in Ramadi, I did not. I was in combat, but I never was awarded the combat action ribbon. So I was like, you know what? I don't care. I'm still going to wear the thing. You know, so I was straight up soul of valor. You know, I'm not going to lie.
But again, it's not like you didn't get in firefights and stuff. The paper, it just didn't get papered, right?
Yeah, so my platoon sergeant, LT, they put it in for it. But for some reason, the paperwork just stopped at a certain, I don't know what the proper steps are when it comes to awards, but it stopped at one of those steps, and it never got fully certified because we got hit before it was actually finished. So that it took a complete back burner, and the day I graduated from the police academy.
Okay, so this happened. That's in 2006 when Ben's wounded.
Yeah,
and so in 2019. He's getting his badge, right? So he's been stolen valor the whole time. It ain't stolen valor, but we're goofing on that. But right, he's let me tell you, he's not the only Marine who's ever done this. He says, hey, fuck it, man. I earned that son of a bitch. Yeah. I'm wearing it. I don't give a shit what anybody says. Yep. And if you don't like it, you can try to come take that shit from me, all right?
Yep.
So,
it's called taking initiative.
Exactly. I'll apologize for it later, right? And again, you wouldn't have to because everybody else would be commenting. The Marine Corps would be apologizing to you, saying, hey, that's on us. We'll unscrew that right now. So tell everybody what happens.
So got the badge, and then...
So you walk out on stage, right? Big ceremony, all these people there, right, at the police academy, yes?
Yep, at the graduation, it was full house, and they're going through their regular things and their regular announcements and whatever their traditional... graduation is, and then they're like, hey, we got a snafu, we got a schedule adjust. Then I saw these two Marines walk up in dress blues. I'm like, oh god, what now? And then they started reading the award announcement or the citation, and right away, right when they said something about Ramadi, I knew right away what they were doing. And said he never got his combat action ribbon. We're here today to award it to him. I mean, they had it. It was great, you know.
So they stop the ceremony. They walk out there. It's a major and another Marine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I believe they're both officers.
What were you thinking when, like, what?
Mm-hmm. I knew because there was a Marine in our academy class who worked at, who did all that stuff for the headquarters of the Marine Corps. So when we first got together and we started talking, we got on the subject or whatever, and I'm like, hey, this was at 6 months earlier. It's like, hey, yeah, I never got my combat action ribbon. He was like, how is that possible? I'm like, I have no idea. But he looked into it just to make sure, you know, dot their I's, cross their T's, and that's when they said, no, someone put in for it. It just got lost, or it just stopped at one of the steps. So they pushed it through, and they gave it to me. So it was almost closure in a way, you know what I mean?
Right, right. No, and, something wasn't done that should have been done. And Ben's not joking. I mean, in the infantry, it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and the whole treatment of it is not – big is not the right word. It's a huge deal.
Yep.
It's a huge deal. And so, no, I mean, if you earned it and somehow they didn't catch up with you, and look, you're seeing – I mean, it seems like on a weekly basis, you see stories of that about World War II, Korea, Vietnam Marines, and soldiers and airmen and sailors that – all of a sudden, this award finally catches up after 70 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, he mused to his congressman at a thing, and then they ran it down, and lo and behold. So what a cool day. That had to be one of the best days of your life, man.
It was very, I felt like I did it, you know, like I finally made it and knew my dad, and Van and Z were looking down with a smile on their face, and I was making them proud.
Right, right. No, this is a very cool picture of Ben with his fist up in the air, right, with all his hardware that he pulled in that day. That's cool. All right, so anyway, so that's kind of a fast forward. Now, we need to tell, and I didn't tell you I was going to have you do this, but I'm going to have you read this thing, okay, so you can read it in your own voice. And people can listen to it, and we're going to talk about you writing and what this means to you. But tell the story about what happened to you in Ramadi. You guys deploy. You're a member of 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, and you deploy to Ramadi. I'm in Fallujah. Ben's in Ramadi. And I saw when the incident happened, I was listening and watching, and I knew something big had happened in Ramadi. But you know, the last thing you ever think is somebody you know is involved in it. And even though the Marine Corps is a small place, and then a couple of days later, I see Grand Forks Marine wounded in Ramadi, and I'm like, what? Like, who the hell? And then I saw Ben's name, and you just keep your fingers crossed that he's going to be okay and whatnot. But tell the story about you getting wounded, and because it's a pretty. The burden that you've lived with, Ben, is not an easy one. There's some people that have survivor's guilt, and they play this what-if game, what-if, what-if, what-if. You don't have to play that game. The only reason you're alive is because of something that happens in this story, and you don't have to wonder, you don't have to wonder if it was because of something you did. You know it's because of something you did, and you've lived with that, and that's why I think your story is so important. So let me get out of the way, and you can talk about what happened.
So February 25th, 2006, we're just 2 weeks away from getting relieved in Ramadi. We just woke up in the morning and just knew today was different, knew that something big was going to happen, and I'm out smoking a cigarette, looking at the Euphrates River, and just thinking, like, today is, I better have my A game, because we're about to get into it. And we have our mission brief, and I belong on a mobile squad, so when the ground pounders or when the foot patrol is doing their thing, we are on the exterior of where they're at, and we're driving around looking for ambushes, looking for insurgents who are going to try and disrupt their movement. And got the schedule, or got the positions. I'm driving, and Adam Van Alstyne is gunning. And I'm out. After the brief, I'm smoking another cigarette, and Van comes walking by with the 240, the machine gun that goes on top of the Humvee. And I just asked him, because I had a feeling like, hey, you should ask Van if you could gun today. And Van comes walking by and said, hey, do you mind if I gun today? He's like, no, not at all, man. Here you go. So we got the trucks up, and we go off on our mission. Our mission was just a regular old cordon knock. So basically we cordon off an area, and then we go in and contact some people. There's two mobile squads out, and we get a call over the radio saying, hey, one's been hit by an IED. We need help. So went to that location, and we just surrounded the Humvee, and we waited for EOD to come out. And unfortunately, we had to wait for the Army EOD because our Navy EOD was busy. And so we waited for about 3 hours to come out. We're just sitting there. And, the insurgents, they're not stupid. They're on their phones. Contact them, they're doing recon of what we're doing, and basically they said, hey, get on your bombs, because they're about to move, or get on your roadside bombs, they're about to move, or if you want to go and shoot them, this is where they're at. We had a car pull up and stick an AK out the window and start firing at us when we're sitting there, and my boy Mahalo returned fire. He killed a guy in the back seat. But we don't know about everyone else because the car was able to drive away. And I just want to say that Mahalo was killed in Afghanistan in 2008 when he volunteered to go over there because they needed combat veterans for leadership positions. And so when that happened, I'm like, yep, it's about to go down. So Army comes out, loads us up real quick, and we're off, and we're heading back to Camp Ramadi to drop our Humvee off, and then we're going to go back to the smaller base called Blue Diamond on Ramadi. And we took a turn. We're on the main route, which was Route Michigan, and we take a turn, and we go through this intersection called Rapid Boundary, notorious for ambushes and IEDs. And we took up the rear because a machine gun, the normal rear of the convoy, their machine gun was malfunctioning, so we took up the rear. And I remember looking, we took a turn, I remember looking at this brick wall, and all of a sudden I'm looking into a white light. I feel myself spinning and flipping in the air, but I cannot see anything because all I see is white. And it happened so fast, it took me a few seconds to realize, my gosh, we just hit a roadside bomb. So I told myself to sit still until I hit the ground, then react. And all of a sudden, I'm above our Humvee, above the wreckage, like floating above it, and I hear this like just horrific yell and screaming, and I fall towards the Humvee. I see my body, and I fall towards my body, and I snap to it, and I realize that was me who was yelling. So I stopped yelling. I tried to move my head. I couldn't move my head because something was on top of it. So I unsnapped my Kevlar helmet, and I looked down at my leg, and it was at a 90-degree angle. And that's when I thought, like, oh, shit, man, wait till my family hears about this. Wait till my friends hear about this. And then I look up, and so I'm laying on my back, and I kind of, like, look over, and I realize that Van was laying there. He was covered in black soot, and I'm yelling for his name, and I knew he was dead because he was not answering, and he was driving the position that I was supposed to be in. And at that time, the Humvee was on top of me. That was the thing that was restricting my head movement, was the turret of the Humvee. And I started yelling, like, Van's dead, Van's dead. You need to get me out of here. And a fellow Marine was yelling for Zanuto, our vehicle commander, Adam Zanuto. And there was no response, so I thought he was dead, too. And he said, who is it? He saw me laying there, the Marine. And he said, who is that? I said, it's fucking Munich. I go, Van's fucking dead, and you need to get me the fuck out of here. And two Marines came to my aid, and of course, what do? They grab the leg that's sitting at the 90, straighten it, and then pull me out from underneath the Humvee with that leg. And that's when I started feeling a lot of pain. And I've started feeling, like, in midst of pain, then all of a sudden I had this, like, enormous fear come over me that I've never felt in my life. And the Marines came and picked me up, the corpsman, Matt Sullivan. He patched me up real quick, and he saw I took off my flak, and he cut off my blouse, and he saw me covered in blood, and he rolled me over, and there's a piece of Humvee or shrapnel sticking out of my back right next to my kidney. He thought it got my kidney, and it didn't. But I had such severe internal bleeding, I looked about 3 to 4 months pregnant. And the corpsman patched me up. Sully patched me up, rolled me over, and then put me in the recovery position. Then he went to work on Zanuto and giving Zanuto CPR and Van Alstyne CPR. Sully, he ingested about 5 ounces of Zanuno's blood, giving him CPR. And so if it wasn't for the swift actions of, and swift and calm actions of Matthew Sullivan, I would not be here today. And QRF came, and QRF, quick reaction force. So when we get hit and we need help and we need it now, we start launching red flares in the air. And the flares go up high enough to whoever sees it knows that, hey, we need to go there now. And QRF heard the bomb detonate, and they were already on the trucks going out the gate because they knew that something bad just happened. And went there, and while we're chilling, we set up triage, or Sully directed triage in this courtyard of this house, and inside one of the walls was an IED. It was a 155 round that my buddy Onan pulled out of the wall, and they're like, hey, we got to get out of here. And we were transporting a lieutenant colonel, I think. It was a higher-ranking officer with us, and we're transporting Blue Diamond. And he saw the wire sticking out of the road, and it was daisy chain. So daisy chain is when IEDs are connected with each other. So if one goes off, all of them go off. And then insurgents, like I said earlier, they're not stupid. They've been studying us. They've been watching our movements, and they place the bombs strategically to space of the Humvee. So every single Humvee was supposed to get hit. And EOD came out after we were already gone, and they said the bomb that hit our truck was a triple stack 155. So three 155 artillery rounds that detonated at once. And they brought me, we transported Camp Ramadi to the main hospital on there called Charlie Med. And that I was, like I said, I was so scared that the fear that I felt was just unbelievable. And they put me, we pulled up to Charlie Med. They already had the stretchers and everything waiting for us. And they loaded me up on the stretcher and then brought me up to the operating table. And they stripped me naked. And they saw my stomach and they're like, we need to get this kid in the surgery right now. Excuse me. And I looked up at the doc. I said, doc, do you mind if I go to sleep? Because they tell us in training, if you get hit, do not go to sleep. Don't try to turn down morphine, all that, because you will go to sleep and you will not wake up. But if you make it back to the hospital and you're still conscious, more than likely you will survive. And he put the mask on me and I went to sleep. And when I went to sleep, they went out to where the Marines were, and he said, Lunik needs blood, and then he needs it now. And my buddy, Onan, laid on the table next to me, and he said, just take as much as you need. I don't care if I pass out. And they just drag-ported blood from him to me, and that just shows you the brotherhood of the Marine Corps, and it's a selfless service.
I can tell you stories about in Afghanistan and in Iraq when they would open, you know, when we have Marines that are wounded bad, and they don't have enough blood. I mean, they put out a call and it's called opening the blood bank, and that goes through every combat operations center in the area. That's, and normally these medical units are co-located with a regiment, a battalion, or whatever. And the word goes out quickly. Hey, we need O positive or O negative or whatever it is. And I'll never forget seeing Marines grab their, helmet and rifle and sprint right to go lay on the table to give somebody else their blood. I can remember doing a mass casualty drill, not a drill, but an event in 2006 after you had gotten wounded. 1st Battalion, 1st Marines had, took a half dozen, between a half dozen and 10 120 millimeter mortar rounds inside of a firm base they were constructing. So they had a patrol that had swung through there. They had engineers in there and the security guys there. And so whoever, I mean, the mortarmen, they'd sunk the base plate the week before. So they knew their rounds were going to be accurate and they waited till enough people were there, but I can still feel the 46s going over our COC, landed next to Fallujah Surgical, kind of a holy place for Marines, and around there, like Charlie Med was in Ramadi, and Marines running down the street to get their blood. And it's one of the things that will be emblazed forever in my brain. Just the selflessness of Marines when they hear somebody, they hear somebody else, is hurt and they need them and whatnot. So I want to fast forward. So you come home and you have this long way back, to the point that you are now a police officer. You, with a combat action ribbon, and you're living the life that you ought to be living. And so when does this idea about you writing, because tell people how many articles you've written for publication in your life.
One.
Okay, this is the first, all right? So how did this idea get into your head that you would write something about Memorial Day this year?
A lot of people have told me, started from my uncle, like, hey, you should document your experiences. And even my friends back home in Grand Forks, they're like, hey, you should document some of this stuff, especially your life before the Marine Corps, because they saw a direct transformation from the time I left the Marine Corps to the time I came back 3 months later after boot camp. And that was back in 2005. And, of course, when I was injured and recovered, and you see all these books come out, and they're about the same. Almost, you could pretty much generalize them to the same thing, you know, the same category, you know, okay, life in combat, you know. But very rarely will you see a book out there that talks about the actual from combat to injury to recovery to, like, hey, I'm finally, 13 years later, I'm finally doing what I want to do. And that's what I wanted to do. And I finally was like, you know what? Because I was going to record something about Memorial Day and what it means to me. And I was like, you know what? More challenging route would be writing. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to take the more challenging route. And I decided to write it.
All right. So, how long does this thing take you to write?
It took about probably 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks. Of course, my general plan was just get all your thoughts out, then organize it, and then go through it with a fine-tooth comb. And keep in mind, I'm not a strong writer, you know, because writing's a skill. The only way you get good at it is if you do it, just like reading, just like anything else.
So this is really a tribute to the Grand Forks public school system. Boom. Yep. Representing, right?
Absolutely, dude.
Red River High School.
Yep.
Booyah.
Yep.
So, no, and you're right. It's not. And if you haven't done it in your life, how to organize it, how to limit the subject so you can treat it in the space that you have available, all that stuff is all learning. And what was, in writing this, what was the hardest part of it?
No, the hardest part of it was taking out stuff that I wanted to leave in there, but I was like, quit being selfish, no one's going to care about that. So I was like, all right, I'll just remove it. For example, I wanted to talk about the day we got hit, but I was like, you know what, I don't really need to do that because there's videos and stuff out there about it. And I was more focused. I need to be more focused on my recovery than my injury / serving in the military. It's time to think about the civilian side, think about what I went through, and think about what drives me every single day.
And that's the message that you wanted to give in it?
Yep. Well, I wanted to touch a little bit on where I was about to give up, and then the majority of it on what rose me up. You know what I mean?
Got it. All right. So what I'd like you to do, if you don't have a problem with it, will you read this thing so everybody can hear it?
Sure.
All right. Whenever you're ready, let it rip.
All right. 13 years have passed since our Humvee was ambushed in Ramadi. I think about Adam Z. Zanuto and Adam Van Elstein every day. I think about how Van never complained and how Z possessed a demeanor every leader would envy. Surprisingly, I think about the fear I felt after the bomb was detonated. I've never felt such an overwhelming fear in my life. The fear was so strong, pain did not exist. People would think the fear stemmed from being mangled and death placing its cloak over me, but I know the fear was the weight of a burden being placed on my shoulders. The burden living out a life that reflects my fallen teammates, Van and Z. When I was discharged in 2006, I was one of the entitled, lazy, alcoholic veterans with no motivation. All I thought about was how society didn't understand my situation. When April 2012 came around, I was ready to be a statistic, but I called out to God and I heard, "Hang on." I hung on, realizing the only person who is going to do the work to get me out of the hole is me. With the help of mentors and my wife, I fixed each part of my broken life, from debt to drinking. I'm here to tell veterans who are feeling sorry for themselves, drinking, popping pills, and walking around with a victim mentality, recovery is out there if you want it. The number of resources is unlimited, but they require you to get off the couch and work. Nothing is going to be handed to you. How do I know I'm living a life that reflects Z and Van's life? I've worked numerous jobs, and I've been attending school. The number one compliment I get is when a manager pulls me aside and says, "Ben, we have hired veterans in the past. They show up late, complain, and have an entitlement attitude. But you come to work motivated, with no entitlement attitude, and never complain. In fact, when you're encountered with a bad situation, you seem to work harder." At least one teacher has pulled me aside at the end of each semester and told me, "Ben, the veterans who come to my class are lazy, show up late, sit in the back, and when I question them, they tell me, 'I'm a veteran, you owe me my education.' Or, 'I'm only attending school for the money, why should I try?' Then you come along, you sat up front, worked, asked questions, and earned an A. One teacher wanted to pull me into the dean's office and demand the dean gives me an award. I talked him out of the idea. The time is now where the veterans of our nation need to step up and become the leaders we are. We should be at the top of everything in the workforce. Veteran, the word veteran has a few stigmas attached to it, including lazy, psycho, and undependable. We need to destroy those stigmas. I know some of you are thinking, well, society doesn't understand what I've been through. That pathetic excuse is no longer valid. The thing you represent as a veteran is something far greater than yourself. Think about your brothers and sisters who died fighting so you could come home. They gave their life for your life. You owe it to their families to get after it. I understand the process is hard. I feel the guilt of Van and Z's death every day. But instead of letting the guilt weigh me down, I turn it into motivation. They died so I could come home and live my life. It's only right I wake up every day and slay the day. Now it's time for you to get off your ass and fix yourself. Don't waste your brothers and sisters' sacrifice. Happy Memorial Day, Lunak."
That's awesome, man. That is absolutely awesome. What do you say to people that might be offended about it?
Good. Hope they are.
I knew that. I knew that was coming, right? People that might be offended by you calling out the pity party.
I hope they are, because that means they realize. I hope they are, because that tells me that they are where I was. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I wasted so much time thinking about that. It's, my gosh, I wasted years that I'll never get back when I could have finished everything. You know what I mean?
Right.
And the resources out there are just dying to help people. I know that because when I really started hitting the ground about this police officer thing, I started going to veteran job fairs. I started going to veteran resume classes. I started going to all these veteran initiative things. And I would talk to the teachers and I would talk to the coaches there. And they said, no one wants to use these resources. It is so hard for them to get veterans off their butt and into the office, because the majority of the veterans out there that are struggling expect people to hand them stuff, expect them just to slide into whatever position they want. But It does not work like that. You have to earn your way up to the top. Even in some veterans have this entitlement mentality where they expect to be hired as like a manager or this high status role. Well, it doesn't work like that. You have to show up to work and you have to work. And it's incredibly easy to stick out. All you need to do is work when you're at work and smile. That's the easiest thing to do. And you'll start sticking out and the managers will start giving you responsibility and start putting you in leadership positions where you do earn your way up to that spot. And I know that because that's what I experienced. I worked at pizza places. I worked at sandwich shops. I just worked at jobs where I needed to support a family. Yes, it wasn't the best paying job, but it was a job. And they were willing to give me an opportunity. And I didn't want that opportunity to go to waste.
That's hard-ass North Dakota stuff, man.
I know, man. Working in 50 below degree weather will toughen you up a little bit.
You know, when I do post-traumatic winning, that's part of the message is we as veterans have so much more to give our communities and the country, and so we've got to get our act together, and mm-hmm. we need to continue to give and live the life of service that road that we went down when we joined. But mm-hmm. the nation needs us, man. The nation needs our experience. It needs our toughness. It needs our pain. Because one of the things that I found out, Ben, is that, you know, at least we talk about this kind of stuff. Civilians don't talk about traumatic pain, right? When it happens to them, they go to a therapist and they do what they're told and they hope to get better. But, I mean, I think that we have such a huge role in how the nation deals with trauma and pain, because we could be mentors, we could be coaches, just like you're talking about. You know, the stuff that you and I know to be true, you're never going to get over it, right? You're going to live with, you know, with the memories you have, right, of Z and Van until they slam the lid on your casket, and they'll probably still be in your DNA fighting it out even when you're in the ground. And so... You know, we can give that. We have a special place as veterans, and we can give that wisdom to other people who don't have a clue about it. We can change their lives. And so it's, and you're tapping into this, and it all starts with taking responsibility and getting after it, like you have most of your life. Did anything surprise you as you wrote this? Did anything surprise you about the either the writing process or how this thing came out?
The number one thing that surprised me was I had a fight to write because, like I said earlier, writing's not my strong suit. So I was not fired up about this, but I knew it was something that I needed to do to start the writing process because it's something I want to do even more of. But like I said earlier, it's a skill, and the only reason a skill gets honed is if you do it more. If you do it all the time, the more you do it, the better you'll be.
So, give people some advice. So, how did you do it? Did you just sit down and write? Did you study anything? Did you watch any YouTube videos? Did you read anything? How did you do it? I mean, from somebody who, as you said, is not a writer. How did you do it?
Well, I Googled books on writing, and this one book popped up called Writing Well. And I read it, and it helped me out tremendously because it's extremely easy to read, and it's extremely easy to understand. And I just basically followed the process of what that book describes, what to leave out, what to leave in, set your pride aside, and fight through the writer's block and just write. And the process I did was just get all your thoughts out, what you want to write about, because it was originally like 2.5 pages long.
Right.
And I had to cut out a bunch of stuff to get it down to, like 3/4 of a page. And it was, yeah, I just kept going through it. And of course, as I'm reading this, I still see mistakes, but mistakes are going to happen. If you're scared to make a mistake, then you're pretty much not going to, you're not going to excel in anything, because that's the only way you learn, and that's the only way you build. So, and
Interesting.
And if you've never told your story, or regardless if you're civilian or military, since we're focused on military, this one goes out to you. Write it, and just get your thoughts out. And once you get that story out, you can start sharing it to people. And people want to hear it. You know, they want to hear our stories coming back, what we experienced, how we experienced it, because civilians don't understand because we don't tell them. You know what I mean? We throw up this wall saying, oh, you don't understand what I've been through. Well, no shit, because you don't tell them, you know. And they want to hear it. They want to hear it more than anything. And I think they need to hear these stories because there's so many stories out there that need to be told that haven't been told. And your story can help someone out, like make their life better, make them get out of a depressed state, make them achieve whatever goal they want. You know what I mean?
Well, I do. And, you know, you said something a few minutes ago that I talk about, and that is, honestly, that if the trauma in your life exists and because of a war, honestly, you're lucky. And people will hear that and they'll say, what are you talking about? But, you know, let me just pull back the curtain in my family's life, right? I have a sister whose two sons were both murdered by her husband when she said that she was going to leave him. 4 and 6 years old, he shot them both in the head and then killed himself in front of my, did it all in front of my sister. Now, nobody Ben or I knows lives near the zip code my sister lives in relative to trauma. And so things that never happened to my sister never goes to a baseball game and says, with all the victims of domestic violence, please stand up and be recognized. My sister never hears that. My sister doesn't get a monthly compensation check because of her PTSD, right? She doesn't get anything. She doesn't have the country kissing her ass because she went through a horrific event. We do. We do. So, I mean, if you could draw up what's the optimum situation to live through a traumatic experience, I will tell you, it's in combat. Because you get the respect of your nation, you get financially compensated, and you have everybody else kissing your ass. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to be humble. And Ben, kind of one of the themes of what you wrote, Ben, is our own humility and coming home and earning it again. And I think if we do that, right, armed with our own humility, understanding that we join this big fraternity of first responders, of people who've been victimized by domestic violence, by sexual assault, physical assault, by accidents, by watching somebody they love die slowly of a terminal illness, that's all traumatic stuff. And we join that big fraternity as veterans. But we talk about trauma in our culture, and we can help them. I know we can, because I know it because I do it. And so to me, we have so much to offer this country, and your message of get off your ass, you know, is spot on. But get off your ass so you can help other people. And when you help other people, you help yourself. And that's really the part of how we transform each other, how we transform our communities. And I think it's an awesome, awesome message on this Memorial Day. So from the English department of Red River High School, well done, bro.
Yeah, word up, man. Only got a D in that class, so...
So what do you, how do you spend Memorial Day? Is it something you avoid? Is it something you embrace? Does it depend on the year and your biorhythms that day?
No, I just treat like any other day, man. Nothing has changed, you know, but well, if you talked to me about 13 years ago, I'd be at the bar just getting hammered, but I can't do that anymore. I don't want to do that anymore. I just, I think I look at Memorial Day as looking back and reflecting what I've done to make Van and Z's family proud, and I will do that until the day I die.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. All right, what's the next thing you're going to write?
I don't know. I don't know, man.
All right. Well, hey, Ben, first of all, well done, man. Well done. The message is good, and I don't think there's any doubt that your dad, Z, and Van are all looking down. First of all, they're laughing their ass off going, holy shit, man.
I know,
holy
man.
Shit, he actually did it. And then they're, but you know, they're proud as hell of what you've done. So, so nice going. Congratulations.
No, man. Thank you. And, thanks for what you're doing. Cause your message needs to be heard and your teaching needs to be heard. So,
well, you're going to be a part of it pretty soon. So you're going to start making guest appearances at the post-traumatic winning. So, we'll get that done and I'm fired up about that. And the, so let me ask you, are you going to post this on Facebook? It's going to obviously go up on All Marine Radio, but where else will you put it up?
I don't have any social platform, bro.
None?
None, man. Garth.
You're like none. Tom Hanks with the volleyball on the island? What's up?
Wilson and I just hanging out, you know?
All right, man. I'll be FedEx for you, man. I'll mail that thing for you. So yeah, anytime you want to get it out, let me know. I'll tag it with your name on it, and I'll even put Red River High School in there to make sure the people in G-Funk, North Dakota, make sure they know it. So
there we go.
All right. Well, that's awesome. All right, bud. Thanks for doing this.
And no problem. Thank you.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How about that? I'm telling you, man, it's an awesome story. And we can, if we're better at mentoring, right? If we're better at mentoring, then maybe we can shorten that transition time from 13 years, maybe down to a couple years, maybe shorter than that. But, you know, it's interesting. If you listen to Ben, you know, what makes sense to Ben? His life showing the Van Alsteins and the Zanuto family, right? That he feels the responsibility to live well because their sons didn't. And that his story can affect somebody else. So I think what's so powerful, especially within our culture, is I'm not doing this for myself. I'm not alone. What I do can influence other people, and that all speaks to me. It all speaks to me really loud. It's just like that which called me to serve in the first place. I didn't go down that road for me. I did it because I believed in those things, and I wanted to be a part of something that was greater than me. And you can continue to be something that's that's greater than you, right? When you serve other people. And I think that's just such a powerful instinct in our lives. So anyway, I want to thank Ben for doing that, man. He's, again, I've known him since he was 19 years old. And he's done great. But I think his story is a great story. One, because of his mental toughness. And two, you know, he hasn't lived, you know, it hasn't been chrome and marble, you know what I mean? It's been working in sandwich shops and pizza places and, you know, and doing those things to support a family, to get it done. And then pointing himself in the right direction and doing everything he needed to do to get there. And so that's what's great about his story. So awesome to have him on. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial. If you missed the first hour today, you're going to hear. I've been getting more and more into Kantian. I've been making maps for the next battlefield study. And so we'll record some of that this week. and excited about it. But I share with you, you know, we talk about this idea of a near-peer or peer-to-peer war. The last time we did any of that was in 1967, 1968, in and around the DMZ at the Northern Ed of I-Corps, right? And the epicenter of all of that was a place known as Kantian. And so you're going to hear me read just some snippets of what the fighting was like and what the casualties were like there. And it's literally jaw-dropping, literally jaw-dropping. So don't touch that dial. All Marine Radio continues. And, I'll post the article that Ben wrote will be appearing momentarily. So feel free to share it. But he's just a good dude. He's a good dude. And he's an example of what it is to be a post-traumatic winner. And the elements of hard work and service that are, and not getting over it, that are all inherent to that. Just a good man. Just a good man. So anyway, very proud to call him my friend. So have a great day. This program repeats itself momentarily on a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, over and out. You know what? Ben Lunick, living the high life. It's our responsibility to live it. That's why I play this song. And he's doing it. It's awesome. This time I'm out. Out.